Now to some reflection on really very recent times, so much more complicated than our own that it takes one's breath away. Let's take the year of 1946. At its beginning, a senior American official who just returned from a visit to Europe went to the White House and briefed President Harry Truman in apocalyptic terms. The very foundations, the whole fabric of world organization which we've known in our lifetime and which our fathers and grandfathers knew was threatened, he told Truman. And the point is, it wasn't an exaggeration. That was the judgment of Hungarian-born journalist-turned-historian Viktor Sebestyen. In his new book, 1946, The Making of the Modern World, he has to thread a creative path between the various epic narratives which present themselves. And I think he does. It was a year of intellectual ferment, he writes, a year when the US dominance as the world's military, economic and financial powerhouse began, the year which saw the shaping of new institutions designed in the first place to prevent future slaughter. Also a year, as we said, when the dying had stopped, when the war had stopped, but the dying had not. It makes the wonders of 21st century Europe all the more amazing. Viktor joins me on the phone now from London. Welcome to the program, Viktor.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be on your program.
Viktor, 1946, a year that sort of gets lost in history, I suspect, a year that laid the foundations of the modern world in your view. Could you just set the scene for us again, please?
Well, the war had ended. It's been 60 million people had died in that war, and almost unimaginable now. And it had lasted a full 6 years of slaughter. There was mass starvation in Europe. There were more refugees. It was the biggest refugee crisis the world has ever seen. It's worse than anything that's happened since. People coming from, there were survivors from the concentration camps. There were huge, there was over 2 million slave laborers that the Germans had used during the war. There was mass movement of people in Europe like you'd never seen. And even in the winning countries, things, the victorious countries apart from America, which had come out of the war much richer than it had entered into it. Britain, for example, was completely bankrupted by it. Mm. There was more food rationing for people living in Britain in the first year and after the war, 1946, than there had been during the conflict. In Asia, of course, was absolutely transformed. Japan was an occupied country for 5 years after the war. The Chinese were in the midst of a absolutely brutal civil war, which basically the 1946 was the year the communists won that war, even though they didn't actually achieve the final victory for another couple of years.
I'd love to just hear from you about your take on the current set of debates around how the Allies behave towards the Soviets at the end of World War II, because, you know, that's been a very live debate, as you say, that in effect the West just passively capitulated, particularly a dying Roosevelt, in the face of this rampant Stalin. That certainly was the view that Churchill had, and that they could have been so much more aggressive, as it were, and assertive to Stalin, and we wouldn't have had the Cold War that we had, and we wouldn't have had the Iron Curtain that we had. I think you've come to a different view.
I've come to a very different view, and that actually has been the view that you've outlined just there, very much historians since the sort of late 70s, and those of, you know, particularly of often of a conservative disposition, that somehow it was a massive sellout to the communists, and it was particularly, they pinpoint the Yalta conference that actually happened in 1945, while the war was still going on, as the point at which the stab in the back occurred. I take a very different view. I don't think those leaders were naive and idealistic. I think they were rather cynical. Some of the deals they had made really was to keep the Soviets, the Russians, fighting the war. They did the majority of the fighting and the dying in the war. And the longer they delayed a D-Day, the more the Russians had to fight. And naturally, they got possession of large parts of central Europe, while the Western powers were waiting. I think they were ensured that the Russians did the dying. And well, I don't think I was naive. I think that was a very calculated move. I don't think by the time that the war was finished, there was much that the Western powers could do. The Soviets were in possession of most of these countries, which they then continued to possess for another 40 years.
Yes,
short of going to war again,
yes,
with the Soviet Union, they'd been an ally for 4 years. I don't think there was a great deal that they could have done.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the essential sort of assessment they had to make. Were they prepared to then take up arms against the Soviets, who, of course, were then very battle-hardened soldiers? Mm. And, of course, I suppose it's at least possible to argue that they would have lost. The West might have lost, and the Soviets could have, you know, come much further into Western Europe. Don't you think that's right?
Possibly. And the idea was also that, you know, the Americans had the atom bomb and the Soviets didn't. So that might have tipped a balance. But the Soviets, Stalin, just reacted as though the atom bomb didn't exist at all. I mean, I think what is coming to is the deals that was made, whether they should have been made, which is, you know, at Yalta and afterwards. And at that point, you've got to remember, the war was still being fought. And the Americans, and indeed the British, what they really wanted was, they didn't know that the atom bomb was going to work at this stage. That was 4 months before the atom bomb was even tested. They actually thought that they'd have to invade Japan. And above all, what they wanted was to get an agreement that the Soviet Union would join the war against Japan when the Germans were defeated. So that was part of the, part of a trade-off. The Americans at that point were still, their military was still saying that an invasion of Japan, which could have been long and very, very bloody, might have cost them, it would succeed, but it might cost 500,000 American lives.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, you've got to take yourself back. Rather, it's very easy after the event, you know, and to look back, you know, after the atom bomb had won, after the war had been achieved, well, what could you have done? But go back, this is the decisions these men had to make then at that time.
Yes.
And I don't think they did such a bad job. They thought that it was a price worth paying to win the war. And I think, looking back, if it had even been a democratic vote, would we have had an extra 100,000 British dead or 200,000 American dead for the sake of Hungary?
Very
or
interesting.
Algeria,
no,
or
I mean, I agree with you. If that's a very interesting prism through which to seek, if we had the vote, what different decisions might we have made? I mean, you've got fascinating chapters, having been to Germany over the holidays and seeing that there were 16 million men lost in World War II, and you make the point that 2 out of 3 German men born in 1918 did not survive the war. A third of all children in Germany had lost their fathers. It was a land of women, children and old men. But I want to just hop over that for a moment to look at the major powers in 1946. And you point out something interesting, that America did not immediately assume the leadership of the free world, and many Americans would actually have preferred a return to isolationism.
Yes, many would, but they were also very frightened of communism. And at that point, isolationism was often in American politics for most of the 20th century, fairly a right-wing thing, which is completely different from, very different from today. But they were so, because of the right was so scared by communism and what, they feared that the communists would take control of all of Europe. This was when the Cold War really, really began and started. They really believed that. They feared that. And the whole Marshall Plan, everything was put in place to prevent that. Roosevelt imagined the American troops would be out of Europe within 2 years of the end of the war. And of course, you know, it was 50 years before American
troops.
But there are still some American troops in Europe. But anyway, it basically wasn't until 1991 and the end of the Soviet Union that the American troops in large numbers left Europe. And immediately after the war, they really thought that there wasn't necessary to have American troops there. But then when they saw the truth about Stalin and just how much the Russians were left with after the war, that changed, and they did take leadership. I mean, the Marshall Plan was an extraordinary thing. It was enlightened self-interest.
Sure. Let me just tell listeners, Victor Sebestyen, is my guest. He's discussing his new book, 1946, The Making of the Modern World. And because we've got such a lot of cover, I'm hopping around. But you also observe something that struck me, I have to say, in Germany this time, that Europe was more ethnically homogeneous after the war than it had been for many centuries, and that it would remain so until immigrants from outside Europe began to arrive in large numbers from the 1960s onwards. Of course, this is very much a factor in the modern old East Germany, where they're really reacting against immigrants because they were exceptionally homogeneous. To that extent, Hitler's dream, dare I say, came true, didn't it, of an ethnically pure Europe?
Yes, it did. Well, he did. The 6 million Jews. There were hardly any Jews left in Europe. That changed the face of Europe completely. Also, what had happened is the population of Germany, despite the number that you said of how many people had died, actually the population of Germany in Crete was bigger in 1946 than it had been in 1939. Which was a statistic I hadn't fully realized until I started doing a lot of more research into it. And that, of course, the main reason was that the Poles and the Czechs and the Hungarians and everything, there was massive ethnic cleansing of Germans. Mm. There'd been Germans living in those countries for centuries. They weren't Germans on the whole that had just been brought in by Hitler in the last few years. They were in Czechoslovakia. Germans had lived for 500 years, same in two parts of Poland, and 11 million Germans were pushed out of countries in Eastern and Central Europe in the first 18 months. 2 years after the war.
Yes, I had no idea of those numbers. I had no idea of those numbers until you put them down.
Yeah, over a million died. Germans died, and of course, not very many people had a great deal of sympathy for them at that time after what had
because they behaved so badly.
The Nazis had done and everything, of course, but it was a pretty great. It was a pretty nasty and horrible event. These were not the guilty Germans who'd run the concentration camps. These were Germans who'd been in their homes. They were ethnically German, but they'd been living there relatively peacefully for generations.
So, I mean, that's why I say it's a sort of miracle to see how much this was transcended. This total calamity was transcended into modern Europe. I just want to sort of draw this to a conclusion by asking you, what are your key conclusions about how this 1946 set up the modern world? Like, what are the specific long-tail effects for good and ill?
Well, for good was that Europe and European, culture and the nation states of Europe not only were saved but prospered for a larger. Okay, they're going through hard times now, maybe, but and the balance has changed. But the beginnings of a kind of European unity and of Western Europe anyway was beginning there. Basically, it was the beginning of modern China. For good or ill, but that was a large thing. 1946 was essentially the year that Israel was. We haven't touched on that yet, but that Israel was created with resonance that we see every pick up a newspaper and we have that every day. And as some countries of the modern of the Middle East, it was basically the end of European dynastic empire. Mm. The British Empire was, it gave up India. That was the year that the British decided basically to leave India. It was, and the French just couldn't carry on their empire any longer. It was, for good or ill, that was the old-fashioned European empire was dead in 1946. These, I think, were the main themes. It was the beginning of the Cold War, which then went on for basically the rest of the century. Mm. it was the beginning of American financial and domination, which might possibly now be tapering off, but who knows? But it's still very much there. They certainly feel it's there.
And of course, just quickly, the EU, the much discussed EU, arose out of this, as you say, as a bulwark against these calamities. Will it survive, in your view?
Yes, I think it will. I certainly hope it will, but I think it will, yes. Maybe not in the form that it's done, maybe not in the, it's made terrible mistakes maybe over the last few years, but the drive towards that is still quite strong in large parts of Europe. And may the generation that saw all these disasters no longer exist, and their children and grandchildren don't feel it with the same resonance. But the idea that France and Germany will ever go to war again, or Belgium or Holland or whatever, is almost, and Italy, is also almost inconceivable. And that's largely through this. Take a longer-term perspective, and the European Union has been a fantastic success in almost every term. And I know that sounds. I get a lot of stick when I say that in Britain. But if you take a pretty broad perspective, it has been a monumental success.
You don't have to argue that with me. I agree with you. If they could just get their banking situation sorted out. Now, look,
maybe the euro was a mistake. Maybe in 50 years we'll see it might not have been a mistake. I don't know. And they've gone for a terrible mistake. But that does not mean that the main principles behind it, the main drive, political drive towards it, the political will towards it is mistaken, just because some people have made some practical mistakes.
Victor, we could go on, but we must stop. Congratulations on all this scholarship, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much indeed for having me on your programme. I really enjoyed it.
And Victor's book is 1946, Victor Sebestyen. It's Sebestyen, Hungarian born. 1946, The Making of the Modern World, published by Macmillan.